And welcome to The Truth About Fiction. I'm Lynn Michelle.
And I'm Derek Thompson.
And we're going to talk about the whole hard, grinding business of being a writer, of writing and being published.
We're going to shatter some myths, break some hearts, and hopefully bring you something inspiring. But most of all, we will tell it how it is. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, we're on. Okay, the recording button's on. I am a non-fiction reader. My name is Charles Topham. I live in Shropshire. I used to read fiction. I don't anymore because I don't think I've got enough time. I've read loads over the years, but I mostly read non-fiction now, magical work, books on grimoires, books, especially old people, philosophers like Alan Watts. I'm very, very keen on the new physics, which is becoming the old physics now, which is quantum theory, string theory and stuff like that. But I have an interest in magic. I love poetry of John Clare. Right across the board, I still read, but I haven't got the time to read other people's stories.
This is going to be a hell of a segue to get back to fiction then, isn't it? It's going to be like crossing a ravine.
No, the creative process is what fascinates me. To give listeners some idea, I'm more than an out of the closet pagan. I'm a practicing magician and pretty much a nature mystic. And I am told by friends in America, I'm what is called a freeform shaman. So I make things in wood. I do staffs and wands, and I do lots of things in talismans and so forth. I am very interested, indeed, almost obsessed by the creative process, not just in writing, because it seems to be the same thing that comes up through writers, potters, people I know that do anything from bug hotels that look like installations. There's a process. There's something happens. And it's very deep indeed. And creative people I know that have it feel that if they're cut off, like Lynn said that day, she wasn't writing. She wakes up in the morning and she has to go and write. I met other people that said, I have to make something. There's that drive to create, to produce something, to express something. And if they're not engaged in that, they feel they're cut off from something, some what you would call a spiritual source. I meet writers like you and I have had many conversations about this stuff, but I also find it in potters, woodworkers. I find it in people that do painting. There's something about the expression of this that fascinates me, because it seems to be a universal thing and it's not always there, like a writer's block. Sorry.
Do you think that, I mean, I'm biased obviously because I write. When it comes to writing, particularly fiction, there's more of a filter. It's less pure. I'm going to say impure. It's less pure because inevitably, if you're writing fiction, you're using established structures. When you work with a piece of wood, you kind of enter into a dialogue with a piece of wood and you see where the curves are, the shapes, the strengths, the type of wood. And that presumably largely dictate, you know, you don't just take a chunk off because you think that will look good. You'll go with the grain. But yeah. I think fiction writing, there are more sort of structures and tropes, and unless it's literary fiction, which is not something I've had any experience or success in, where it's more freeform, you're going with a feeling, you're going with a sensation. I think fiction, and probably especially the sort of fiction I write, you're filtering it down into a number of different established shapes, different facets of a known gem, a certain sort of cut. You embellish them and you change them because obviously you don't want to keep writing the same book seven times. But I think there's a similarity. And for me, if I read other people's books broadly, I can see what the template is. And that might be because I'm more into plotting and characterization or dialogue.
No, I think this is, for me, I'm fascinated by this. You know, it occupies a lot of my thought. I mean, I had one day where I was working outside I had probably about 8 staffs lined up in a row, and I used the curly wood with the clematis has been in. So this spirally, they look very Gandalf. They look very, you know, that kind of thing, really that kind of shamanic staff. And there were 8, when I looked up, there were 8 to 10 people outside. They were all people, all craftspeople that had hired the local youth hostel, and they were walking around. And the 8 to 10 of them came into the flat. We were all on the same wavelength regards to this creative principle, if you call it that. And what interested me was, I spoke to quite a few of them afterwards. They stayed in touch, email. And some of them were potters, some of them worked with jewellery. And after a while, their own style, everybody starts with copying somebody else. You can often tell where somebody has come from in any creative form, and you can see where they end up. Andy Warhol, you could see where he'd settled on a particular form, a particular way of expressing particular colors, and that he reiterated that form so many times, and people copied it, and they developed their own thing. People do develop their own style. And I find out, because it's very hard to break out of once you have a particular thing. Very hard to break out of, indeed.
I think that's especially in my experience, serial writing. So the book that's out tomorrow, by the time this is out there, the book that was out previously is book two in the series. What I've tried to do is call back to the first book. And because most of it is through a main character, you largely see the world as he sees it. So in the first book, it's the sort of classic fish out of water idea. You have a London copper who gets exiled to Wiltshire. And you see the people around him very much through the lens of his experience, which is quite jaded. So, you know, he's a Londoner, so he thinks that no one is quite as smart as him. Then in the second book, you revisit those relationships as part of a new plot. And you realise that what he thought was going on, and the people who didn't seem to have a clue, had a far greater clue. And that his experience has changed, his perception has changed. And I think with the spy novels, because there's five of them, each time I wrote one, I sort of pushed against it and tried to go a different way. So one book was a sort of classic long man in the right place. The next book was a sort of locked room mystery with a bomb. The third book was a classic, a list of suspects and who did it, like the sort of film noir where they have to investigate all of them like Gumshoe. The fourth book was a defector spy novel. And the fifth book, which is the strangest one really, Flashpoint, is about the London bombing. So it draws on that paranoia and fear and agencies competing with one another. So each time I've tried to do something different, but with the same characters and still broadly in the same genre. Then my take on it, I suppose.
The thing is, spy fiction's changed so much, isn't it? My dad used to have all of the books at home, and I read quite a bit of fiction in my younger days, really. I think, you know, people, the thing is, they have to reflect something about yourself, don't they? I mean, not intentionally, it's a subconscious thing. Whatever you are, whatever your needs, fears, and self-censorship, what you'll put into a book is naturally, you know, like this, you can swear as much as you like in a book, but you couldn't put that on screen for the BBC. You couldn't put it on American TV because you can't even say shit on American TV. Or, you know, it has to be BS. Everybody knows what you mean, but you're not allowed to say it. That's something, however much you try, however much, even with most the things I do, however much I think, well, I'm going to try something different. I never do, because this thing that comes out from me, which makes it unique to me, they're peculiar to me. The ones I make, nobody else is making anything like that. I think it's sometimes with this book, not your books in particular, I was thinking about generally with an author. Like you say, you can, when I think about when I used to read stuff, if I read Michael Moorcock, you could read a Michael Moorcock book at 100 yards in a thunderstorm, you know it was him. And you could also tell people that he influenced years later that borrowed bits. You can tell a Tolkien template from a mile, you know.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think about Quest for the Faradorn, which
I
love, but some people hate. Or even the William Morris novels, or Dunsany, what's his name? George MacDonald wrote Lilith, which is a great book. Must read that again. I mean, it's interesting what you say about censorship, because, of course, unless you're writing songs, or you're writing books, unless you're doing phallic stuff. In craft, there isn't a lot of censorship, but I think in writing there is. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think I told you this before. One of the criticisms, one of the first, a few negative reviews for the first spy book, someone said, I think it was an American, and they said, I didn't appreciate the bad language in the book. I didn't know there's going to be bad language. And my response to other people is, well, it says bollocks on the first page. So the clues were there. And I did that deliberately to illustrate character, which is what I think dialogue does in the real world and on the page. And also to set the tone in the same way that a lot of the books, they'll have a gory murder on page one, so you know what you're getting. My books don't, because I'm not really into gory murders. That's not how I write. Probably a whole lot of reasons for that that a therapist can unpick. But I think the best writers don't self-censor. And some of the writers in Joffrey books, some of my stablemates, not only brilliant, but much more graphic. And some of them have had experience in the police service, as we're supposed to call it now. So they're probably drawing on their own experience and the things they've seen. I think for me, try not to draw my own experience, because I want the books to be about something other than me. There are guns, there's a reference to an armed robbery, so maybe.
Yeah, the thing is, you made a good point there, you see. In your books, the characters aren't going to do anything out of character, are they? They're not suddenly going to, you know, one night they're going to be kick-ass with a costume, leaping around rooftops in Lycra, you know, sorting out the local crime in some hillbilly town in the West Country. They're going to be within character over an arc. If you have five books with that character in, like Thomas Bladen things, you know, you can see Thomas Bladen possibly getting older, a bit more jaded, a bit more cynical, and thinking, you know, like, everybody does in all these old cop things like the Sweeney and Frost, they all go, I'm too old for this, like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon 4. You can possibly see that, but they're not going to do anything suddenly that takes you out of the realm of, he has credibility, doesn't he, in all of these Dunbar. Consistency,
yes and no. I mean, I liken the five books, and I'm actually working on, spoiler, I'm working on book six now. It's gone in all sorts of strange ways. But I liken the books to a kind of corruption, a descent into hell, because in the very first book, I suppose there's a sort of, in the very first book, he's only ever picked up a gun once, and that was when he nearly shot his dad. Long story. Yorkshire.
Justified.
He thought so. York miner strike, you know, the revolution that never was and perhaps should have been, where people were getting weapons off the boats that came in. So in the first book, never really picked up a gun before. By the fifth book, not only more seasoned with guns, but without giving too much of plot away, involved in a fatality. So there is some character development, and but what you say is right. I mean, I really wanted to avoid, like in the James Bond films anyway, where it's each film is almost, before Daniel Craig, who I think has been brilliant, but before then, each film was almost a rewind. Oh, and here's James Bond again. Yeah, nothing's really changed. He's sort of eternal. There's no consequence. That's the thing I wanted to do in the books, and even in this, the new series, if I can call it that, with book two, that there are consequences, and they're usually consequences carried over from previous books, because that's what interests me. In the same way that, you know, people over the years, and particularly if you've worked anywhere for years and years, someone who starts off as an enemy might become a friend or an ally, and conversely, people you thought you could trust stab you in the back and you realise that they're not to be trusted. Often, but not exclusively, management. Strange, even when you are in management yourself. So yeah, there is that sense for me of always trying to push at the boundary, but recognising there is a boundary. I mean, Thomas Bladen wouldn't get a machine gun and say, right, let's get him and go in and just assassinate him. Actually, thinking about it now, I think he has killed other people. Now I think about it. Because someone said, he's not much of a spy, you know, not much happens. And I was going through it, I was thinking, right, drugged, shot someone, killed someone.
Car chase?
No, it's not really.
In the book, isn't it? How can you?
I don't think I put a car chase in, because they're not very interesting to write.
8:45 and pursued him in all the least direction.
I was driving around the North Circular, and blow me if we weren't stuck in traffic, and I couldn't get past him because there was temporary lights. But I think one of the things I did like about Thomas Bladen, I thought, was a well-observed review. I liked it because it was funny. What I like about him, someone said, is that he doesn't have any special skills. His talent, if you like, his skills, are the people around him. I think it's more naturalistic. He doesn't, I mean, there is someone in the books who's done Bojitsu and all of that, but it isn't him.
Yes, so it's
a strange one, because you're writing fantastical scenarios, but you're aiming for a degree of realism, because you want people to think of the characters as sort of real people. You want them to care, essentially, or why should they go on reading if they think, well, they're bound to get out of this, and you know, the government will be there at the end and the flag goes up.
One of the things that's interested me about, I've known a few writers over the years, on and off, certainly when I lived in London, and I didn't really fully understand what they were engaged with. And one chap I used to know was a brilliant idea. He used to hang around probably the wrong way for it. He used to travel on the tubes and certainly the buses, and he would pick up conversations between people. And sometimes he'd get something he ended up writing for the Young Vic, different things. There would be lines in the play here and there, because it was fringe theatre, basically. You'd hear something, oh, you think that was fantastic. And he said, no, that came from two old ladies sitting on a bus on the number 25, headed out towards the East End, going through St. Paul's.
Yeah.
And they were talking about something. And it was brilliant. You could, you know, how much dialogue you can borrow from real life and put it in there. That gives it some credibility, underscores it. People would think that's something my nan would have said, or my. But I do I one of the things that does intrigue me, and we've not really talked about it too much, is how a character can almost develop its own life.
Yeah,
some
I think,
degree of autonomy. That rivets
I think that's what you want, actually. When I wrote the fantasy novel, I've told us before when we were talking about dreams, but when I wrote the fantasy novel, one of the characters said, speak to another character and ask him what happened to his brother. And I thought, well, that's intriguing because he hasn't got a brother. And then in the court, you go into this kind of gestalt inner dialogue. This is the way that I work in with the characters. You talk to them, you ask them questions. It's like mediumship with fictional characters. And it turned out that one of the characters had been involved in this kind of scientific, but he blew his brother up. They were in a homemade lab and there was a fire. And all of this, most of which didn't make it to the book, but it gave me an insight into the character. There was a depth to it that I hadn't created. And with Thomas, I just shut my eyes and visualized and thought, right, okay, what's there? And I saw someone sitting at a window, a pair of binoculars. And I said to him, what are you doing? And he said, I'm on surveillance. Because I thought it was going to be, I thought I was writing a detective novel. I thought, oh, this is great, because I love detective novels anyway. And it turned out that wasn't the case. And he said, I'm a surveillance officer, gave me his name. By the next day, I already knew his name, where he lived, his age, how he'd met his partner. And also, sort of bizarrely, as I pulled the car up to park, as God is my witness, he said,
This is it.
Something that you saw. God of literature. He said, this is how I want the book to end. So this is before we've got the whole plot. And he said, I want this and this and this. Honestly, like a hostage take, he said, and I want a helicopter at the end. And I said, well, where am I going to get a helicopter from? Because he said, oh, I want it to end on the Yorkshire Moors. And I said, OK, right. And I knew nothing about Yorkshire. And the fact that it came from Yorkshire was funny. I think I'd
been
to York.
Banking is out for years, haven't you?
Yeah. It's from some bloodline DNA thing. And he said, and I want a helicopter at the end. And I said to my imaginary friend, well, where am I going to get that from? He said, the Yorkshire Police Air Support. Craig Wilde, who's the copper in the new books, I don't know him as well. I know bits about him, but he hasn't arrived fully formed. It's taken us a lot of time to walk around one another and also to avoid the tropes of he's a heavy drinker or he's got post-traumatic. I mean, in the books, he's involved in an armed robbery. He wasn't where he was supposed to be. Yeah. It all went very wrong and a member of the public got shot. A lot of it fell on his shoulders and he sort of fell apart for a couple of months and they were going to pension him off and strings were pulled. And instead of that, the next best thing, he was sent to Wiltshire, which he loathes. But in actual fact, it's turned out it's been really good for him.
And like Hot Fuzz, really.
I suppose, but not as many laughs. Yeah, in a way, the difference is with Nick Angel, and what a great film that was, might I say. Not as good as Shaun of the Dead, but still good. Nick Angel was sent there because they were all sick of him. This guy was moved out there to save his job and pension. That was the compromise that his Police Federation representative got for him, because they needed someone, a fictional area of Wiltshire called Maybury, because their police sergeant vanished.
Oh, right. OK.
Which is alluded to in book two, which is why the locals sort of hated him, because they thought, well, why have we got this incomer?
Yeah. Do you know, I mean, my dad was, as you know, my dad was in the police force.
Yeah.
I mean, just his full 25 years. And sometimes somebody would appear up here from some far-flung corner of London, and you think, well, what are they doing up here? It's because they were unpopular. Do you know, in the 1800s, my great-great, whatever he was, grandfather, was a policeman down in Cambridge. And he ended up in Yorkshire because he was so unpopular in Cambridge. And it's true. I mean, he was hated. You know, he was one of the peelers with a truncheon and... As you say, no consequences. And they just said, you know, we it's a bit like RoboCop, really. You know, we love you, but one thing that interests me, like I say, is the idea from almost like a string theory point of view, a quantum physics point of view, whatever you call it, that somewhere out there, there's an energy signature at a particular frequency somewhere out there, which is your character, which becomes self-aware. This is magic we're talking about. It becomes self-aware at some point. You know, you go to a spring for 1,000 years and offer votive offerings there, Romans, Bronze Age people, blah, blah, blah. At some stage, it becomes aware of itself, sentience. And I wonder if these characters somewhere do have that.
You think about characters like John Rebus. Me and Rankin was writing him for 20 years.
Yeah.
And obviously that then for him, with television and presumably radio, that seeps into popular consciousness, that becomes a thing, almost like a shell or another facet of the archetype of the lone detective, whether that's Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple, Poirot. It's a sort of a modern, like you were saying, about the specificity of time and culture. I don't know. What intrigued me, I can pick apart Thomas Blaydon now and say, well, but even then, the picking apart is a construct. And I think, well, parents, Thomas's parents, his dad's a drinker, he doesn't have a lot to do with them, are called James and Helen. And I realised much, much later, after the first book, that's all creatures great and small, probably, James and Helen. No, but I know why that is, because, as luck would have it, we were on the Isles of Scilly, on St Agnes, the best of the islands, and there was a book there, Heriot's Yorkshire, and it happened to be there when I was writing Standpoint, or some of the ideas and plotting. And it was perfect serendipity because they had maps. And that's how I figured out that Pickering would be the place. So small wonder that James and Helen would kind of seep into my consciousness. But other bits of his life, like the minor strike, which gave me his age, the scene, very vivid of him.
It tells you what music he would have listened to, doesn't it? You know, what food he would, what fashion was around. You almost, the culture, the habitus, the thing you live within gives you the form, doesn't it, to some extent? Have you ever seen him in real life? Have you ever bumped into somebody and thought, Christ, that's the man?
No, I'll tell you what is interesting though. I've got, it's going to hold up a picture, but it's not much point because it won't show on a recording. I don't know where it is. But I saw one picture in a newspaper. And I thought, that's him. He looked to me vaguely sort of lean and wolf-like. And one picture of Miranda, his sort of half-partner. Quite a flat-faced, blonde, sort of London-y, Essex sort of people I would have known growing up or wanted to know, possibly. But who can say? Probably not. I think I've created a character that would intimidate me, and does him. And when I was in discussion with emails with the publisher, I said to him, if it helps any, these are the pictures I have in my head. And he sort of replied back and said, that's nothing like how I thought it'd be. And Carl, who's this Northern Ireland guy, he reminds me a bit of Rod Gilbert, but
nice.
Shorter and a sort of fatter face and hair sort of more red. And again, the publisher saw him as something totally different. But I was once over a beach in Cornwall and I saw this couple and they were walking along a beach, and I put in my journal, Thomas has grown a beard. I don't think it suits him. I've just seen him and Miranda on holiday. And the funny thing is, it made me think they never get none of the characters, because I try and focus on the bits that interest me. So there's rarely, if they go out to a meal, because it's sort of, there'd have to be a point to it. They'll be watching someone or someone's watching them, or it's integral to the plot. So there's a lot of real life that doesn't make it. I think that's one of the tips they give for writers. Write your book and take out all the uninteresting stuff. And I think you're right. I think also, though, once you can visualize them clearly, it's easier to enter into a dialogue with them, because you know who you're talking to. It's not just a disembodied voice. But yeah, I use the whole dialogue with the character technique a lot, because it just tells me things I don't already know. And that is an established technique. You would interview them, so you'd have a list of questions. Tell me about your father, tell me about... That's not quite how I do it. In fact, some of the time, it's almost like they're the actor and the character. I'll say, right, this is the next scene. What do you plan to do? Because I don't know. And I'll kind of mentally...
Yes.
Oh, because you know the characters, you know that sober Thomas, working class, massive chip on his shoulder, inverted snob, because his boss used the word ergo once. He and Carl, his mate, take the piss out of her and do the thing with air quotes, ergo, we need to do that. So he's...
Welcome to my world.
There you go, exactly.
But a little chip on each shoulder.
Yeah, exactly, for balance. But knowing he's like that means I know that I can put him in a formal setting, like a restaurant or formal dinner, and he'll be A, incredibly uncomfortable, and B, will make a tit of himself.
How much of yourself do you see in that character?
Almost none, and that's the joy of it. The only thing we have in common, the idea of an observer, I suppose the outsider, but all of those books are outside. Craig's the outsider because he's travelled in. That's something they have in common.
The observer, not the observed.
Yeah.
You see, I there's so many things that come up. I mean, we've had some great conversations, Derek. You know, I many, many times you and I have had a conversation about something, and I've gone away and thought, yeah. And it will stay with me for a few days after, sometimes a lot longer, you know, things pop up and think, yeah, we were talking about that. You know, there's this thing I have about Alan Watts used to talk about it a lot. The best stuff, standing outside of yourself, really, or letting the I bit stand to one side or working through it. Well, I've been making something and I'm really into it. The bit that is me making something and all, it all goes and there's this whole flow and I don't even know what time has happened, come and gone. You know, I'm not really aware of being hungry until very late on because something else comes through. When I'm not thinking about it, the best stuff comes through and I think, wow, did I really do that? And I mean, I don't think it is me. I think there's something else. All the people are crafty. Their best moments, I don't know where it came from. It just, do you find that with your writing? Do you have moments where you think, do you know, it's almost like you were channeling something. You were a conduit. You were the hollow pipe. You were the hollow bone for something to come through.
Actually, yeah, occasionally. There was one particular scene, book two, again, just going back to Thomas Blaydon. What was the second book called? Line of Sight. There's a scene where one of the characters, Carl, has gone back to Northern Ireland for the first time in years, and it's explained in the book why he can't go back, really. And his mother's dying in hospital. As I remember it now, I might feel differently if I read it now, but it was a perfect scene. Everything from the moment he arrives in a hotel, and there's a knock on the door, and he doesn't know someone's coming for him, and he looks around, and all he's got is the cutlery on the tray. You know, he's got a plastic knife and fork, and he thinks this is it. From that to visiting his mother, who is really the very last stages of her life, you know, the last few days of life, and their interaction, poignant and sweet, and possibly I was drawing on some of my own experience with losses in the past, I don't know. There was a kind of integrity to it, I think that's what I'm trying to say. I get that more in dialogue and plotting, and if I'm honest, and they don't always make it to the final cut, some of the humour develops organically from the character. It is as if the characters, I'd be thinking, okay, so he's giving him this or that, that's not quite how it works, but I know how the scene is playing out of my head, and the character will come out with something and I'll say, that's brilliant, or that's very funny, or that makes sense and wasn't the way that I was going to go. But I have had characters say, no, we're not going there, we're going up here. And that's interesting because of that, and that's happened in the book that I'm writing now. Both the characters have a religious person in the family. The idea that there's a kind of sharp divide, that the family went left and you went right, or vice versa. And it's a tension. Plots, I think all books need various tensions of various strengths to hold the thing together. It's like a dynamism between characters.
One of the things that never seems to communicate itself to me in the written word is wordplay. I mean, you and I very often make puns. We have wordplay around lots of things.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if it always communicates itself to the written page that much.
No, I don't think it does. In fact, I had a review, a recent review, because you get the sort of pre-launch reviews, and one of the reviewers, I can't remember exactly what they said, because, you know, you don't keep your wounds. No, I can't remember what they said, but essentially it was one of the characters made a joke about one of the other. The copper, Craig Wilde, he's in his late 30s. His partner, somewhat, he's a detective, and she wants to join the plainclothes. And her name's Marnie Olsen. Somewhere in there, one of the reviews had said, Craig made a joke either about or for Marnie Olsen, and she didn't get it, and he thought that was funny. And the person said, I didn't get it either. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think wordplay, it only works, I think, if you've got a character that does that. Banter, the way that we do, it becomes a subtext or a sort of a pared down language.
There's something about American comedy as well. They don't really get wordplay very well, English wordplay. And we've had people know about Python, they know about that kind of stuff. And there's bits in the IT crowd where Jen says about putting somebody on a pedal stool. And when you hear it written, exactly, when you hear it written, you only hear it spoken, you write that joke down. I've seen it on the written page from scripts from that time.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any impact. It has to be verbalized, vocalized.
Americans, particularly, they don't appreciate that sometimes. They say, oh, it's a very British book. And I think, well, the clues were all there.
They all love Downton Abbey.
Well, apparently. Or the ones who love Downton Abbey loved it. And maybe that's it, though, because Downton Abbey, a lot of it happens above stairs. I do use slang. I love a bit of slang.
Yes.
We actually have a glossary in the books.
Love it. Is it the same slang they used in Fools and Horses?
No. No, definitely not.
That's a different generation of slang, isn't it, really?
Yeah, no one says, God bless you, Governor. The slang is quite international, I think, because you pick up terms. I mean, you think about even language that's considered British. shampoo, doolally, all of that. Yeah,
something being pucker.
Yeah, pucker, exactly. We use it in very nice pies. They used to do a tofu pie, as I recall, but they took that out of circulation. It's interesting, this idea of culture and being authentic to what you're writing about, but also knowing that that will be interpreted and experienced by people with other cultural reference points. Some will like it because they like to, as I do, immerse yourself in a book or world or music that's different. I like difference, but some readers...
Yeah, I do. I think I was going to say, one of the things is I don't think there's enough diversity anymore. No. You know, and you think about a book like Cloud Atlas, which I think made a wonderful film. You've got real diversity there. You know, you have to put yourself in, you have to invest in that book to really get into it. You have to rethink slightly all of the forms that have come before. Do you know what really put me off reading fiction? And it's the day I thought, do you know, I can't be asked anymore. It was Dan Brown. Lazy, just churn out.
You know, you're channeling Stuart Lee now, aren't you? You'd like to.
It was Dan Brown. And a couple of people said, oh, people who obviously didn't understand me in any shape or form, said, you know, you got to, get with Dan Brown, man. It'll just, you know, it's like really deep. You know, that voice people pull, you know, it's really deep. It's awful stuff. And I thought, that's what fiction's become.
Yeah, but it's populist fiction. I mean, my books aren't Shakespeare.
Really?
I know, it's a shock. To be or not to be Thomas Blaydon. Punch. But one of the reviews I was happiest with, it might have been a 4-star, I can't remember. Other petrol is available. The person said something like, it was a good holiday read. I was really chuffed for that because I thought, yeah, that's what I'm aiming for. I've done clever, none of which have paid off, but I've done clever things with the spy novels in that there are references to ultra, that's an interesting choice of word, ultra clever reference to the CIA that no one's picked up. There are callbacks to books. There are little Easter eggs in there if people read the series and get it. And there's even a reference to that series in the new series, but the new series takes place about 2018, whereas the first series, the Thomas Bladens, is currently at 2005. So they're separated by some distance, and that's just the way it happened. It's partly because I wanted the London bombing in the spy novel, so that was 2005. And in the cop series, I wanted to make it more modern. I didn't want to do that thing where you write about stuff and someone said, oh, I reckon there'll be a referendum one day, you know, because it's set a few years ago, with it being clever. I didn't want to do any of that. Anyway, listen, I'm going to wrap up this, but it's been a joy as always. So thanks for your time.
No, thank you. I'm flattered to be asked, to be fair. It's something you and I have discussed quite a bit, really. That I am riveted by the creative process is quite a dismissive, throwaway, lazy way of putting it, but something happens when you're tapped into, and we're not talking about the muse, you know, which is inspired and wistful, and I mean, that's something different, but this is something else that feels at a universal level or an astral level, if you're an old-fashioned spiritualist, you know, something that is looking to be expressed, and you have one person who can express it better than the others in some form or another.
You hear about these situations where there are two films that come out around the same time with very, very similar ideas. I mean, leaving aside all the studios heard about it and stole it off them, I think it was Bugs Life and Ants came out at the same time.
Yes.
The Matrix, yep. And Equilibrium, which is a great film. So maybe these sort of universal ideas or these frequencies, two or three people tap into at the same time. I don't know. But I do think that the creative process does involve a shift in consciousness.
Yes.
And that's almost the secret of it. You cannot, I certainly can't. I can't sit down and say, I'm going to create... I can't do it in a clockwork fashion. This character goes here, this character goes here. I have a sort of process, and for me, I need to be able to walk around the building or the house or wherever they are. And I do that in my mind a lot until I know where everything is. And from then, I follow the characters around, and often they're moving and I'm sort of filming them. And you feel it as well. Because
J.K. Rowling went through the same when one of the characters got killed.
Yeah. I went through the same experience when one of my books bombed, but that was that was a different sort of death. Anyway, listen, I'll leave in peace, but I'll catch up with you another time.
You will. Thank you.